All right. Welcome, everyone, to another Wednesday evening here in America on peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel Like a Ball. I've got a very special guest on tonight. I'm going to read a little bit of his bio. I want to welcome first a little bit of his bio, John D. Vernon. John was born in Plainfield, New Jersey. John and his family moved to Mansfield, Pennsylvania in 69, where he quickly learned that life on a remote homestead required hard work, dedication, and long hours. John graduated from Mansfield Junior Senior High School in 1977. After graduation, he enlisted into the Pennsylvania National Guard, later enrolling into the senior ROTC programs at Rutgers University, where he earned his commission as a second lieutenant in the infantry branch. John has proudly served the United States of America for over 37 years as a military officer, retiring at the rank of colonel, a Department of Defense civilian, and township supervisor. In 2012, John ran for the conservative candidate for the U.S. Senate in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He now resides in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate you having me on tonight.
Yes, it's very good. I know you ran for the Senate, on the federal level, I think you're still a regular guy. You're not much of a corporate candidate, so to speak, or at least I hope you don't consider yourself a corporate candidate, do you?
No, I don't consider myself a Washington insider, and I hope to continue to change that. I think most people today really want to see themselves represented in Washington, and that's what I was hoping to bring to the fray.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You're also an author, too. I think that's one of the main reasons why we got connected. We wanted to talk about your book.
Yeah. For many years, folks have been after me to write a book, and it's, folks who have gotten to know me and who have heard my story, especially on the campaign trail, have encouraged me to write a book. And, about 13 months, to the date, I sat down and, started putting pen to paper, and, 11 months ago, we were, able to publish, Angels Watching Over Me, which is, my biography, my autobiography, and, which is, very spiritual, but also has, a very specific meaning, about, how to be self-reliant. And, I'm hoping that it inspires folks that, read it, to kind of continue to, do what they're doing, and not get sucked into government dependency.
Yes. Too many people do. I believe that a lot of people that, do go into government have good intentions, and somehow they get sucked into the dark side, as it's called, they get sucked into the crime and the, corruption and all of that that goes with Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well, it's not only in, Washington, D.C., and I'll just tell you a brief story. In Pennsylvania, your readers can, while I'm, talking to you and while they're listening, they can go on the internet and they can, look up, the former Speaker of the House. And he was, sadly, a Republican, John Crisell. Purcell, was the Speaker of the House, and he had gotten arrested and convicted of various charges. But I met him at the Republican Club down in Philadelphia. And one of the things that was mentioned to me was that, if I, talked to so-and-so, all of my, financial problems could be, taken care of. And, being a hardcore military man who believes that his integrity is everything, I was not going to get suckered in, political corruption. And I didn't take the bait, and I never made the call that he asked me to. And I believe that, you know, I'm a better man for not doing that.
Certainly. Do you know what that actually reminds me of, John? I think it was a couple of years back when there was 30 or 40 candidates. One of them happened to be Texas Governor Rick Perry. And there was a video that, actually it was just an audio tape that surfaced, and somebody allegedly come up to him and said, we're with the Bank of America. We want to talk to you, or something like, you know, something to that effect. And that kind of ruined his little chance at becoming president.
Well, you know, I like to believe, you know, being a Christian, that people can change. But, you know, money has a way of corrupting folks. And I don't believe that, you know, our forefathers believed that that was the purpose. And so many people today think that that's old school and, you know, that's not relevant. So many members of Congress are, you know, literally, there's not a lot of distinction between them and K Street, you know, the lobbyists on K Street. You know, they get paid a whole lot of money to do a whole lot of nothing. And, you know, I actually, you know, would support, a much lower pay salary, for members of Congress, as well as, personally, I think they should compete like everyone else. If we're talking about retirement packages and healthcare, the Affordable Health Care Act, which I'm not in favor of, I'm actually a believer that that should have full repeal. I don't believe that they should have something different. You know, members of Congress, you know, put on their pants and skirts just like everybody else. And they shouldn't be given special perks because they're not special. You know, the people that they represent, in my opinion, are the specialists.
Yeah, I guess we can go over a few of them little special perks that I know of anyways, and a lot of us know of. Lots of people, millions of people just don't realize what the people in Congress and the people in government get. If one was to run and win a race in Congress or the Senate, they could serve just one single term and either get thrown out or voted out the next election, and they would get a pension every single year for the rest of their life, 100% full pension. I think their pay is currently it's like 174 to 175 thousand for somebody that serves in the Congress.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I would tell you, Stephen, having been a federal civilian, federal government workers are not in the same category
right.
as members of Congress.
Right.
And so they have to pay for their health care and they have to contribute to their retirement.
Certainly.
You know, any mention that, you know, they get some kind of special perk or they get some retirement given to them by the government is simply false. And it's, again, something that even as a member of the military, retired member of the military after 32 years, I pay for my health care. You know, that's obviously an option. It's a decision that I've made to pay for TRICARE for life so I can, you know, see civilian doctors. But it's, you know, I don't have any problem doing that.
Right.
You know, obviously it's at a reduced rate. I don't want to take something for nothing.
Absolutely. Well, I guess before we go any further, let's get into your book and let's talk about your book and talk about what it's about.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I, you know, mentioned earlier, you know, I was encouraged to write my book, Angels Watching Over Me. A lot of folks have asked me about the title. I actually started writing the book before I came up with the title. And as I got into the, you know, various chapters, it became very obvious that I had both spiritual and physical angels watching over me throughout my life. And as a man of faith. You know, I have a deep conviction as a Christian to God. I'm very fortunate to be married to a wonderful woman for 35 years. And I knew that when I met her, she was the one. And as it turned out, she would be one of the angels that would save my life. And I've chronicled that in chapter 7, which is titled Touched by the Hand of God. And that's where my wife saved my life while we were stationed in Saudi Arabia, unbeknownst to her and to me, that a car bomb would explode outside my office window.
Okay, yeah, sorry about that. I was just muted there. Go ahead and get into the explanation of this incident you're talking about.
This specific incident occurred on November 13th, 1995. I was the operations officer for the U.S. mission in Saudi Arabia as part of the office of the program manager, which was responsible for equipping and training the Saudi National Guard. And it's a program that's gone on for many, many years and actually had its origins prior to Desert Storm. And I learned of its origin when I was an advisor to the Saudis up in the Eastern Province during Desert Storm when I was a captain out of the Ranger Training Brigade at Fort Benning, Georgia. So the opportunity, having, you know, been rode hard and put away wet when I was promoted to major to, you know, take my family on a diplomatic assignment that was, you know, again, you know, something that the Saudis paid for, you know, was an opportunity that I jumped at. And based off my experience, I was made the operations officer for the combat division. So on that particular day, November 13th, 1995, as folks were, you know, it's mid-November, there's, you know, our annex building was maybe about a mile and a half from our diplomatic compound. And that's where my office was, as well as, you know, many of the other offices, the, you know, the various staff sections, whether it be administration, logistics, security, communications, what have you. And but at that same moment, there were folks that were planning to, you know, return to the United States. You know, for Thanksgiving, and, you know, they typically would take 30 to 45 days, which was never an issue. And it was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day. I can still, you know, visualize it.
Do you know what day of the week that was?
You know, not off the top of my head. But it, you know, obviously, you know, folks can look at it. It was, you know, a work week. It was not a Thursday or Friday. I can tell you that, because that was the in the kingdom. Those are the two holy day, or two. That's basically the weekend. So that's the Sabbath there. I believe it was a Tuesday, but I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. It was just a gorgeous day. 70 degrees. The palm trees were swaying. Gentle breeze. You know, things were, you know, going well. There was not a lot of, milestones that needed to be completed. And my boss, who was a colonel, had flown out to the Western Province in Jeddah, to visit some dignitaries and, brigade commanders there in Jeddah. It was a very low-key day for me. And my wife worked for installation management over on the diplomatic compound. And she had called me and said, "Hey, you know, are you busy?" And I said, "No, not really." And she said, "You know, I'm going to be coming over. Do you want to join me for lunch?" And the cafeteria was a couple doors down from my office, not very, very, very far. You know, it was just something that, you know, having, you know, being an operations officer, you know, for those who have walked in those shoes, they understand that, you know, you put in a tremendous amount of hours, you know, almost, you know, from the crack of dawn till, you know, late at night, 6-7 days a week. And that's what my wife had lived. So the opportunity to have lunch with her husband, you know, was a very welcomed opportunity. And it was welcome for me too, because, you know, I love my wife dearly. And so she had come over, you know, to grab the distribution and hit the mailroom. And, we ordered lunch, together, and we had just some, you know, great, human beings, who ran the cafeteria, as, host country nationals. And, who, you know, never had an ill word to say to anyone. Who, you know, had, you know, were like family to us. And so we had ordered lunch, and, because of, you know, the upcoming holidays and, you know, kind of the lull in, you know, the work activity, the cafeteria was really buzzing. And, they were really, really busy, and you know, they said it would take 15 or 20 minutes. And, so, you know, based off of that, you know, my wife didn't want to leave things in my office and, said, look, let me go back to my office. I can be back in, you know, 15 minutes, and I don't have all these packages and, envelopes and, things that, you know, are business related, that I'd have to leave in your office, in, you know, a non-secure mode. And so, you know, I just said, all right, well, let me walk you out to the coaster bus, you know, vice you going out alone, I'll help you carry this stuff. You know, I took her outside and, you know, put her on the coaster bus, and, you know, coaster bus is basically like a, you know, 20 passenger, you know, minibus. It, you know, I could, you know, literally see the, you know, our diplomatic compound was only a mile and a half away. And, you know, she's driving away. And as I lost sight of the bus and I, you know, started walking back up the stairs and, started punching in on the cipher lock, I heard this crack and then this loud boom. And I remember looking up, not realizing that I was on the ground. And I could see this mushroom cloud of dust rising up. And the door of our building, was, you know, literally, you know, lying, at the top of the stairs in front of me. And I knew something bad had happened, but I was definitely in a fog. And I got up and I ran inside the building. And I think it was all natural instinct, to do so. And I got maybe 25 feet in the building, and I could see a man that I had never met before, and he was not scheduled to be in our building. He was there because someone had gone on leave back to the States, and he was there temporarily in our accounting section. And he was sitting, he was on the floor, just, you know, up against the doorwell. And I could see he was badly injured. And I, you know, grabbed him and took him out of the building because, I could smell, you know, the leaking, propane or natural gas. And, for the next, probably 90 minutes to 2 hours, I don't remember how long it took. We were all in the rescue mode, and recovery mode. We had lost, 7 of our colleagues, and there was over 60 wounded. And, you know, we were literally conducting, you know, a mass casualty triage, event. I ended up, you know, going up on the second floor after I treated the gentleman that I just talked about. And I was bare from the waist up, because there was no, equipment or bandages, to be had. I mean, there were first aid kits, but, you know, you're talking about mass triage. And, when I went up on the second floor, our, personnel non-commissioned officer, he was a sergeant first class, Thaddeus Thigpen, had this, he was very badly wounded in his neck region. And I could hear him breathing out of his neck, and he was not conscious. And I grabbed him, and, you know, picked him up in my arms. And he was a pretty large man. And I got him outside, and I was able to commandeer, a suburban vehicle, of a local national who was equally shocked. He was just, you know, you could tell that he was in shock. And, you know, based on the carnage, and I was able to put these two gentlemen, inside the back of the vehicle, and on pieces of plywood that we had, you know, just found, outside. So this was all, you know, we had improvised, and, you know, my Arabic was not very, very good, and his English was not very good. But he was able to say hospital, and I was able to say yes, which in Arabic is nam. You just say nam, nam, which means yes. And he, you know, drove to the hospital, and he's looking back at me, as we're driving. And of course, you know, the rules of the road are, you know, not like they are here in the United States. I guess, looking back at it, the hospital that we arrived at, which is stuck in my mind, was called Rose Hospital. And, we were not the first to arrive. There had been others that had arrived, prior. And, the emergency personnel came out with their gurneys and, got these, two wounded men, in and in into the ER. And I really didn't think that Sergeant Thigpen was going to survive. But while I was there, word had come out that the people that had perpetrated this attack, and they were called, we learned later, they had gone by the name of Tigers of the Gulf, were the origins of Al Qaeda. And they were going to, they had threatened, or they had put out, that they were going to attack the hospitals and kill the wounded. So myself and another lieutenant colonel stood guard there. And as I said, I was a major at the time. We stood guard over our wounded. It was, you know, something for me, for one, and because after 24 hours, you know, we were relieved, and you know, folks started, you know, literally standing guard to protect our wounded. We never left them alone. You know, whether you think that was something symbolic or not, but as you know, a person that served in a Ranger unit, and as you know, part of the Ranger Creed, you know, we have sworn an oath that, you know, never will we leave a fallen comrade, though we be the lone survivor. And so, you know, that was deep in my heart and deep in my mind. And 2 days after the bombing, and this is this goes to the belief that, you know, my life being spared, was an act of divine providence. I was designated as the commander of the honor guard, element, to ensure the safe return of those that had paid the ultimate sacrifice. 2 days after that was my birthday. And on that day, we conducted the memorial service for the fallen and those that were wounded in the courtyard of the embassy. And I write about that in the book, that there was not a dry eye. It was standing room only. And I remember sitting there with my wife and hearing the names read, just like 9/11 and the bell toll and the violinist playing a dirge that would just tug at your heart. And every year, I'm reminded, every year that I celebrate my birthday, I'm reminded of that incident. I think, at least in my mind, that God has spared me so that I can do something else, and that every year I will remember that, so that that will allow me not only to serve him, but also to do something good for the people.
So was that actually a IED that you encountered then, John?
Yeah, it was a car bomb that had it's estimated about 500 pounds of plastic explosive and a series of propane tanks. Not as sophisticated as the IEDs that we experienced in Iraq, but clearly powerful enough to do the damage that it did. And the pictures that I put in my book are my own, of the building, as well as of the bombing vehicle, which the engine of that vehicle was discovered on a building rooftop over a block away. So that gives you some idea of the powerful nature.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Engine blocks can weigh anywhere between, 450 to 600 pounds.
Right. And our building was a couple days after the bombing was condemned. I mean, it clearly was not inhabitable, but structurally it had been damaged so badly. What actually saved, you know, many of us, was there was a about a 4-foot berm and it was not deliberately dug. The parking lot on the east side of the building, in order to level it, level the parking lot, needed to be reduced.
Is that like a ditch or something?
Yeah, a berm is basically just think of it as about a four-foot wall.
Okay.
Of dirt. And so they had pulled, and we used to park our vehicles on the east side of the parking lot, in various rows. It was just a dirt parking lot. And so while our vehicles were parked there in rows, they drove the bombing vehicle between our vehicles, perpendicular to the building. So just imagine if they had been able to have put the building in sideways, and what would have happened, especially if we had not had the berm, the building would have definitely collapsed. And so with what the berm does with that kind of blast is that it funnels it up vice in, even though there was a residual effect of glass and concrete and metal that did go through the building, and that was the shrapnel objects that people were wounded by.
Okay, yeah, that's all sounds pretty wild. There wasn't any kind of intelligence or any kind of information that this was going to happen then, was there?
It's funny that you asked that, and I don't mean that to be coy.
I'm sure you must receive threats a lot.
Well,
being over there,
I do, but if you can recall back into the early '90s, out of Desert Storm, Saddam Hussein was the threat in the region. And it would be considered, and this is my term, heresy to think that there would be an internal threat in the kingdom. And I mean, after all, we were there as, the guests of, the royal family. And that was considered one of the safest places to be. Unfortunately, and as would come to pass with 9/11, it would be, Saudis that, not only perpetrated that act, but Saudis who would, perpetrate the act of 9/11. And so we didn't have that read. Our chief of security, who was a lieutenant colonel at the time, and I talked to him a couple weeks ago, I think I mentioned to you, I was on Southern Sense Radio down in South Carolina, about two weeks ago. And, he happened to call in, having heard that I was on the air. And, that was one of the things that I talked about. I mean, he and I had, you know, talk to the leadership about that, the threat, it was mainly him more than me. I will not take credit for that. But he had predicted surmised that the threat was internal, not external, based off of things that had gone on, whether it be a grenade attack by Hamas, some small arms fire on some other Western compounds, more sniping than anything, and that there would be, this was kind of a test or build up to something larger. And that he felt that if there was going to be an attack, we would be a prime target because we were considered soft in the sense that we didn't have the standoff and that it would be very easy and that the attack would be in the sense of a car bomb in the east parking lot. That prediction during a meeting with senior leaders was had in August, and in November of that same year, it came true. He actually had said the way to prevent it would be to put a fence up, and to provide some standoff. And that was discarded, again, as kind of, and again, my words, heresy, that it would be, an insult, to members of the royal family. And it would be somewhat political suicide, from the ambassadorial level, to suggest such an attack would happen, based off of speculation and conjecture. Hindsight being 2020, afterwards, we actually got a hold of as many Jersey barriers as we could and cordoned off about 8 square blocks. Our children used to go to the international school, and we'd run these armed convoys as well as run counterintelligence missions and some other operations, but it was consuming us to where we couldn't do the job that we were there to do. And the State Department ultimately ordered our families home through a non-combatant evacuation. And even then, the terrorists were not abated. They actually threatened to blow up the aircraft that our families were on. And so our baggage, all of our family's baggage, went out of the international terminal, but our families actually, under the cover of darkness, flew out of the royal terminal, miles away, that was heavily guarded. So as not to have that kind of international incident, international act of terrorism. A second time. And of course, many folks are familiar, the following year, was the larger bombing up in the eastern province, at Khobar Towers.
Yes, I do recall that now. I actually remember both of them bombings you're speaking of now, but I guess what kind of an impact do you think this, that particular day has had on your life, John?
Well, it really puts your life in perspective. You realize that you can be here one day and gone tomorrow. One of the gentlemen that paid the ultimate sacrifice was a guy named Wayne Wiley. And Wayne was a retired Army major, and I had known him from Fort Benning. And he had, I was only a captain at the time that I knew him. And of course, when I got over to Saudi Arabia, he had retired and I was a major. So we were, basically peers. To talk to someone, one minute, and have them gone the next is the realization that it's the gravity of what you do. And it also allows you to look at your family and hug your kids a little tighter, not be so coarse with your wife, and be a little bit more appreciative because you know, again, they shoulder a lot of the same burden, and that was a lesson that my wife, when I was headed back to Iraq in 2007, I was a full colonel. And I was headed to Iraq. I had just come from U.S. Forces Japan as the deputy director of operations for U.S. Forces Japan. And I was going to Iraq to be the chief of operations for strategic operations or C3 for Multinational Forces Iraq, which was commanded by General Petraeus. And I remember sitting, it was about 3:30 in the morning, and, we were at a Denny's at Fort Benning. It was, the last breakfast that my wife and I would have together before, I would leave. And, my son and my son-in-law, were already in Iraq at the time. And, you know, it's, you know, never easy, having done it multiple times. You know, talking to your spouse and, my wife talking back to me. And, you know, it's a, you know, kind of a nervous conversation, and you try to assure each other, in a, you know, very positive way that things are going to be okay. But, you know, she knows that, the metal of what you're facing and the stress. And I had mentioned to her that, you know, look, you know, I'm going to watch over the boys. I'm going to be okay. And it, you know, don't worry about it. And of course, those words, don't worry about it, were probably, you know, ill chosen. And I mentioned that in the book. You know, she, very quickly, you know, clips my Colonel Eagles and, brings me back to, you know, ground zero and says, you know, you don't understand. My husband, my son, and my son-in-law could all be lost together, and I don't want to be alone.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. And so those words, Stephen, I think that my wife spoke, represent the words of all the military wives and husbands, who had loved ones deployed. And it was that fear, that their lives could be changed in an instant.
Yeah. Too many people's lives have been changed in an instant, you know, whether it be an act of terrorism or just, an act of God.
Yeah.
Well, it is really good that you didn't perish on that day, or any of your two sons, a son-in-law.
Yep.
I guess we got about 12 or 13 more minutes here. Would you like to talk about your senatorial run?
Sure. You know, after I retired from the military, and, you know, folks that know me know that serving the Republic is in my blood. It's, as I have mentioned to you, my roots, you know, my family roots back to, our family farm well before I was born, back in the Revolutionary time, where the Battle of Monmouth was fought on our family farm. You know, serving this great nation, is, what our family has been about, whether it be in the Revolutionary War or the Civil War. In fact, I have relatives that served in the Michigan 5th Cavalry during the Civil War. And, you know, we have only been unrepresented in, Vietnam. But so, the point being that, after military service, you know, I traded in my uniform for a suit and tie, because folks, like, as I mentioned earlier about writing a book, had encouraged me to, get into politics, that I had the right stuff, and that I would be, again, one of the right guys that could change Washington and that could represent the people as our forefathers had done. And so, I knew that my background was a complete contrast to the incumbent Senator Bob Casey, who had never, he's a senator currently in Pennsylvania, who had never served in the military and who had, you know, literally, you know, as attorney general and had ridden the coattails of his father, who had been governor, had these, you know, part of the left establishment. And who had, you know, represented, you know, President Obama, and voted with him 97% of the time. And he was nothing more than a talking head. And I believe that, the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania deserved better. And so, I filed my papers and said, no experience needed here. I've been serving my country for 30 plus years. I'm pretty sure I can handle the job in the halls of Congress. And off I went. Much to the dismay of the establishment GOP party in Harrisburg. And you know, when I met the chairman and his staff at the fall convention, they were very disgruntled and not very glad that I was in the race. What they wanted was a self-funder. And basically they had already thrown the race away. They were not in a presidential year. They didn't see that race as being winnable. I ended up coming up against a gentleman who had been on the left and who 6 weeks earlier or I should say had been a Democrat, hardcore Democrat his whole life. He decided to, you know, come over to the right. And he had $50 million. And sitting on his patio as I was trying to convince him not to run, but to support me, he made it known that he was willing to spend his $50 million, in order to win the race. And I saw it as just another, progressive ploy, you know, as I had mentioned earlier, you know, to buy a seat, which was, you know, exactly what is wrong with Washington. And, make a long story short, he spent $29 million of his own money and lost. Now I suspended my campaign before that, because I simply couldn't compete with that level of finances, even though I had put a couple hundred thousand dollars of my own money in. Tom Corbett, who was the governor, had shut the funding off on me. And, you know, the elitists stood around and watched me bleed out.
He had shut the funding out on you.
Yeah.
All
of the big donors. And, it is a way, that these elitists and establishment types, can keep people who are not hand selected and, who are not the wealthy.
Yeah. So they just didn't offer any type of corporate funding for you. Is that what
exactly?
You mean? Okay.
And so anyone that has been in a campaign knows that it takes money to run a campaign. Now, you know, I have no regrets. I mean, I spent a couple hundred thousand of my own money besides what I had raised. I do it again in a heartbeat because I believe in serving the people, and eventually I'll get there.
And you happened to mention yesterday in the chat we had that you do have aspirations on trying for the Senate again.
Well, not necessarily just the Senate.
Just the Senate? Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know, I would serve in any position. I can serve the people. I mean, having served as a township supervisor, Stephen, and, you know, people can do their research up in Rutland Township, Pennsylvania. I took a township that was $200,000 in debt. And when I left, we were almost $500,000 to the good.
Well, hey, think about it this way, John, you've actually got more experience than Barack Obama does. He was just a community organizer when he first started running.
Yep. And, you know, probably one of the things that I'm most proud of is that we were able to dissolve a long-standing establishment of nepotism that had gone on. The chairperson of the township, her daughter was the secretary treasurer. Her other daughter was the tax collector. You know, there were resources that would just disappear. There were, you know, six or seven different bank accounts. Treasury accounts didn't balance from month to month. You know, it's like running your checkbook. You know that at the end of February, if your balance is $100,000, your beginning balance of in March is $100,000. And that was never the case. And so, to strike them, out of the township, and to start anew. And, it was myself and another gentleman who was he was one of my brother's supervisors, and our two wives, we ran that township, for, about three months till we could hire people, and get them in there, because the intent was to, the folks that we had gotten out of there was to shut that township down and make us quit. And they'd be back in business again, doing what they were doing. You know, I just, you know, again, I've never quit at anything, and I wasn't about to, you know, start there. And, you know, we turned that township around, and I'm a big believer that we can do exactly that with Washington, with the right people and the right support. And I'm not talking about money, but it takes votes. Votes carry much more weight than money does.
Well, I think it's going to take another thing, too. I think it's going to take literally millions of people shutting off the corporate news, corporate news agencies. They all handpick their candidates, as you happened to mention there a little while ago. And if you're not in that club, you're not going to get any kind of recognition.
Yeah.
With the media. You know, speaking of Congress and the president, what do you actually think of this administration here? And what do you think of the brand new Congress and Senate?
Well, you got a whole bunch of questions there.
Well, there's just two, but
yeah. Okay. But, let me just start with, you know, this administration, Stephen, has been, from the point that, the inauguration address has been over their head. And one of the things that troubles me, you know, I can put up with someone who has a lack of experience. I can't put up with someone who has a lack of integrity. And literally, they have given away their honesty. And so whether it be you can keep your doctor and you can keep your healthcare plan, which we know are both lies, or that in regard to the IRS, that there's not a smidgen of corruption, or we look at the fact that the characterization of the Islamic State in Iraq, Levant, is a JV team, knowing that genocide is occurring and that it's not a JV team, is dishonest, as well as, you know, if you don't show up for your daily intel briefings. You know, that's a disservice to the American people. And so the leadership is lacking greatly. And, you know, I look at that and say, you look at how our military has been dismantled. This is not the military that I remember. You know, I'm a huge believer, that marriage is between a man and a woman. And, so with the, I guess the recall, of, don't ask, don't tell. I was not happy with that. As well as the political correctness that, here we are today. We, you know, the president talks about, he was, you know, on the news tonight talking about how there's not going to be a long protracted war in Iraq. He's not talking about boots on the ground. Well, you know, that in itself is dishonest. We've got 4,000 troops on the ground in Iraq right now. And so what you're going to hear from Josh Earnest, the press secretary, is, well, you know, the president said, he didn't say we weren't going to put boots on the ground. We just said it wasn't going to be protracted. And we see protracted as being 10 years. They may be on the ground for a year or 2 years or 3 years. And so, you know, our military is stretched so thin. But the rules of engagement and the, you know, he's, you know, I've never seen any leader, and I don't consider him to be one, who is so open about telling the enemy what we're not going to do. Now, as far as in regard to members of Congress, I see them as so politically correct, they're ineffective. They couldn't pour pee out of a boot with instructions on the heel. And I don't care if you're talking about, you know, obviously Harry Reid is, you know, the largest obstructionist to have ever probably walked the halls of Congress. And Mitch McConnell and John Boehner just aren't getting the job done. You know, they've forgotten that, one, they have taken an oath and that they work for the American people. I'm, you know, personally tired of the rhetoric. You know, we should have repealed Obamacare a long time ago. We should have repealed the Patriot Act. We should not be growing government. We should be going with a limited government. We should be getting out of people's lives. You know, we should be looking at what the NSA is doing. The fact that the president has said that the NSA is not spying, not listening to people's phone calls, when in fact we know, based on their own admission, that that's not true. You know, the failures of our intelligence agencies and the characterization, you know, by the one of the co-chairs of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, who's more concerned about how we this enhanced interrogation of terrorists when we have genocide going on in the world, where children in Pakistan, 132 of them, are being slaughtered, heads are being cut off, Christians are being crucified, and they have the audacity to say that the Taliban is not a terrorist organization. And so I look at that and I really have a disdain for members of Congress. Now, that does not hold true. You know, that labeling does not hold true to those recently elected, because I've not seen them yet perform. But I look at the attacks on someone like Senator Joni Ernst, a combat veteran out of the Iowa National Guard. She commanded a transportation company over in Iraq. And there have been folks on the left that say, well, you know, she really isn't a combat veteran because, you know, she wasn't on the front lines. I go, you know, you have no clue what you're talking about. You know, in an asymmetric warfare environment, where rockets and mortar rounds and IEDs abound, every person that sets foot in that combat zone is a combat veteran. And so to be a divider, which is what the president is, he's been a divider, since he took office. He's not about, trying to unify the world, or even unify the country. It is about dividing the country. So, as I look at this administration and the role of Valerie Jarrett, who is about as progressive as you can get, and you check her background, you know, right out of Chicago, working for Mayor Daley, actually fired by Mayor Daley, you know, the some of the other folks that are there, you know, you look at the former chief of staff in the White House, now the mayor of Chicago. You know, you look at the crime that's going on in Chicago, supposed to be a gun-free zone. You know, the mantra of Black Lives Matter. How's that working out, Mr. Mayor? You know, it's when you ask people, Stephen, are you better off 4 years ago, or let's look 8 years ago or 12 years ago? I'd say people say no, they're not better off. You know, they're paying more taxes. We've got 48,000 people on food stamps, 48 million people on food stamps. The college loan debt is $1.2 trillion. And out of that, you know, the government has made $66 billion in profit. Corporations are making record. I mean, look at the stock market. But here, our own government, is taxing corporations at the highest rate in the world. You know, we should be leading the charge in innovation, in industry, in technology. And right now we pay the Russians to go into space. What a sad twist. And we have people like Al Sharpton, who is a known race baiter, getting off scot-free at who owes $4.5 million in taxes. But yet you and I, come 15 April, we better make sure that we pay our taxes. So I look at that, Stephen, and I'm deeply troubled because, our leadership does not respect the rule of law. You know, when you have 90,000 illegals come across the southern border and they disperse them throughout the country, knowing that they are not going to report, as instructed, and where they select laws that, they are going to enforce, where border agents get killed by weapons that have been gunwalked. On and on and on. The scandals. I mean, just look at how we treat our veterans. Congress can't even get that right, much less the commander in chief.
Exactly.
He's forgotten.
Exactly.
That it's not just the active and reserve and guard forces. He's the commander in chief of even our veterans. Our veterans are our troops too. So, you know, that's what happens when you elect someone who has no muddy boot experience, has no idea what it's like to serve.
Well, he's never actually had a job in his life, if you really want to get down to it.
Absolutely. And
right
so,
up.
You know, when you look at, and I had mentioned that to you the other night, you know, the whole left progressive, crowing.
Mantra, if you will.
Yeah, is about that American wealth has been stolen.
Yes.
And really, they are stealing. They are stealing from the American people. We are being taxed to death.
Absolutely.
American corporations are being taxed to death.
Yeah.
Small businesses today are being gone after by the IRS. These are, you know, agencies that can threaten, that can, send out agents that can seize.
Armed agents.
Yeah. Armed agents that can seize bank accounts. You know, you have, you know, they talk about, a bogus system. Look at the FISA court.
Yeah.
And I'm embarrassed to say the word court because it's not a court.
Yeah.
There's no judge, and there's only one side.
Absolutely. Do you know that they have virtually did away with the white collar division of the IRS, and they've nearly tripled the blue collar division of the IRS, and they are all armed. 16,000 plus IRS agents are all armed.
Yeah. And you know, Stephen, one of the things that I write about in chapter 11 of my book, which is a collection of essays, I am a huge believer in the abolishment of the IRS and the repeal of the 16th Amendment. And I would do so through the establishment, of either, as Herman Cain had mentioned, a 999 or a flat tax, and then, transition to the fair tax. We have so many government agencies, that are, in my view, the arm of tyranny, on the American citizen. You know, I was recently, my daughter told me this past Christmas, the news that I'm going to be a grandfather. And while I was overjoyed with that news, I was saddened, as many folks are, to know that when my granddaughter or grandson is born, they're going to be saddled with $65,000 worth of national debt. I mean, this president is the one that who has candidate Obama said it was unpatriotic of George W. Bush to have run the debt up to $9 trillion. And here we are at 18 and growing. And, you know, he keeps talking about the deficit. And that is nothing more than a ruse. It's like I'm watching The Wizard of Oz and pay no attention to that behind the curtain.
Don't look at the little man behind the curtain. Exactly.
Yeah, because and so when you look at, and it's what I call the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which is apathy, ignorance, gullibility, and I'm trying to think what the other one is. I'm getting a Rick Perry moment. The point is, I mean, you look at most young people, not all, but a lot today in academia and throughout the world or throughout the country. They have no idea that the president traded five high-value terrorists for Bo Bergdahl, a deserter, and that, you know, based on pressure from the White House, this is being stonewalled. And you know, that the storyline or narrative was that he was in his health was in grave danger. Really? How come the physicians at Landstuhl Hospital found within 48 hours that he was in fine health?
Yeah.
And so I look at that and again, Stephen, my experience over in Iraq, when we would capture, you know, these terrorists, during combat operations and they'd go down to Camp Buka, you know, we'd be doing biometrics on them. So we'd have retina scan, fingerprints, pictures, the whole nine yards. Some of these fools we had picked up four, five, six times and ended up releasing them. And this is what goes on.
Yes.
And, you know, the president is so driven to empty Guantanamo. And ultimately, if you look at the direction, he's legalized or he's normalized relations with Cuba. I see that, you know, if he can pull it off, he is going to give that back to the Cuban government because he sees that as that our occupation is that of one of colonialism.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't see it like that. And, you know, we have to face up to the fact that we are facing Islamic terrorism. You have to know your enemy in order to defeat them. And the fact that the president talks about using the word destroy, and that's totally confusing to members of the military because you cannot destroy an ideology. And so if the commander in chief is using the wrong words, and his staff is using the wrong words, and the latest Pew poll tonight says that 73% of Americans believe that the president has no strategy to defeat ISIS. I mean, here we're not even 48 hours after learning that another the last held American hostage has been killed. And while we've run airstrikes, about 700 of them, we used to run that within about 2 days of an air campaign. And here we are 6 months in, and the White House keeps talking about a 60-member coalition, but we're doing 95% of the airstrikes. And the military effort doesn't sound like much of a coalition to me.
Exactly. Well, John, I've run over here a little bit. I just wanted you to get through all your thoughts and all that, but I do want to end this here, so I do appreciate you coming on. We can do this again if you'd like.
Absolutely. You just let me know, Stephen. You're a great host, and you have a great heart, and I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate the opportunity to have me on and talk about my book
and have a little rant, right?
Yep.
All right. We will speak soon. John Vernon, thank you very much. I passed your Amazon link for the book into the chat room there. And it's, I'm sorry. I need to bring it back up again so I can say something about it. It is Angels Watching Over Me, an American story of one man's determination to serve the Republic.
Awesome.
All right. You said you were going to give me a copy of that, so I will. I'll have to send in the Skype chat here what my address is. Thank you once again for coming on.
Thank you, Stephen. Have a great evening.
Have a good night.
Take care.
All right, everyone. I'm out of here for the night. I will see everyone real soon. Probably going to be next Wednesday, my next show, unless something else happens in between now and then. So, everyone, Stephen Roberts, and this has been Cancel the Cabal on peoplesinternetradio.com. I'll see everyone soon.